What I would recommend would be nothing less than radical. We needed an entirely new navigational computer system that would take advantage of the transistorized circuitry now coming into development and projected for the marketplace by the late 1960s. I suggested we model the missile's onboard computer on the design of an actual dual hemisphere brain with one hemisphere all-over receiving global positioning data from orbiting satellites. The other hemisphere will control the missile functions such as thrusters, positioning changes, and booster stage separation. It will receive data through a low-frequency transmission from the other lobe. The control lobe will also transmit missile flight telemetry to the positioning lobe so that the two computers will function together in tandem. This, I reasoned, would make the system more difficult to jam. If our global positioning satellite detected a threat from an incoming anti-missile missile, it would relay that information to the warhead, whose control computer would direct the thrusters to fire so as to take evasive action before the final target approach. Inasmuch as I believed it was through the application and amplification of low-frequency brain waves that the EBIs navigated the craft that we found at Roswell, our implementation of this technology might enable 102. Us also to use our brains to control the flight of objects. We could use some form of a brainwave system to navigate our ICBM warhead final stage vehicles if their onboard radar detected a threat from an anti-ballistic missile. We could also use this system to home in on incoming enemy warhead launchers even if they were capable of taking some evasive action. If we designed the missile the way I suggested, by the time it had been locked into its final trajectory, its detonation would be set so that even if it were knocked off course it would still explode and cause enough collateral damage that it would count as a hit. Enough of our ICBMs could get through, we reasoned, so as to overwhelm not only the Soviet-guided missile forces but pose a realistic threat to their population centers. Meanwhile, the technology we developed for changing the flights of our incoming ICBMs could be applied as a template to our own anti-missile missiles so as to neutralize any Soviet missile threat. My conclusion. An appropriation of $300 million must be requested for the coming FY 1963 as urgent crash development appropriation. I read my own notes from the envelope handed over by Harold Brown and looked back at him. Colonel. Brown's assistant said. We understand the urgency of your request last year and we appreciate your reasons for fighting for it now. But the Defense Department is simply not going to allow the Army to go forward with an anti-missile missile at this time. Not in 1963, Mr. Brown said. When? I asked. At a time, the Army colonel said. When the impact of our deploying this system will be greater than it is now. The Russians know we have a bead on the type of satellites they're putting up and we can take them out in a heartbeat, much faster than they can take out ours. I began to answer, but Harold Brown got up to leave. We shook hands and he walked toward the door. The Army colonel remained in front of my desk. Maybe just you and I can have a word, Colonel Corso, he said. My own associate on Senator Thurmond's committee left the office also. In the Pentagon, we understand that your early research into the technology of the anti-ballistic missile is the real reason for your support, Colonel Corso, the project manager said. It's in good hands. But I can tell you he didn't know the real reason, the EBIs. Only General Trudeau understood the secret agenda that lay beneath the research into the project. But when do you think development will start? I asked. In just a couple of years we'll have lunar spacecraft orbiting the moon, he said. We'll have orbiting satellites mapping every inch of the Soviet Union. We'll see what they can throw against us. Then we'll have exactly the kind of anti-missile missile you proposed because then even the Congress will see the reason for it. But until then, I began. Until then, the colonel said. All we can do is wait. It would take another 20 years for the beginnings of an anti-missile to be deployed. And it would also take a president who was willing to recognize the threat from the extraterrestrials to force an anti-missile weapon through a hostile Congress. 103. Chapter 15. My last year in R&D, the Hoover files, fiber optics, supertenacity, and other artifacts. I barely picked my head up from the piles of technical proposals on my desk during the winter months of 1961. The work didn't even stop for the Christmas holiday, when most of Washington likes to take a break and head for the West Virginia mountains or the Maryland countryside. I was traveling a lot during the final months of 1961, seeing weapons undergo testing at proving grounds around the country, meeting with university researchers on such diverse items as the preservation of food or the conversion of spent atomic pile material into weapons, and developing intelligence reports for General Trudeau on the kinds of technologies that might shape weapons development into the next decade. With my other eye, I was keeping a lookout for any reports going to the Air Intelligence Command about UFO sightings that I thought Army intelligence should be thinking about. The AIC was the next step in classification from the Project Blue Book people. Its job, besides the obvious task of moving any urgent UFO reports up the ladder of secrecy to the next levels where they would disappear behind the veil of camouflage, was to classify the type of event or incident the sighting seems to indicate. Usually that meant separating real aircraft sightings that needed to be investigated for pure military intelligence purposes from either true UFO sightings that needed to be processed by whatever elements of the original working group were on watch or false sightings that needed to be sent back down to Blue Book to be debunked. The AIC loved it when it had actual false sightings it could send back, an obvious meteorite that they could confirm, some visual anomaly having to do with an alignment of planets, or, best of all, a couple of clowns somewhere that decided to pull a Halloween prank and scare the locals. There were guys running around wheat fields with snowshoes or submitting photos of flying frozen bitons to the local papers. Then the folks at Blue Book could release the story to the press, and everybody patted themselves on the back for the job they were all doing. Life could be fun in the early 1960s, especially if you didn't know the truth. Moving into 1962, Army intelligence was lit up with rumors about potential threats coming in from all over the place. The anti-Castro Cubans were mad about the president's refusal to support the Bay of Pigs invasion and were looking for revenge. Castro was mad about the Bay of Pigs invasion and was looking to get back at us. Khrushchev was still furious about the U-2 and the Bay of Pigs and thinking Kennedy was a pushover, would soon jump on an opportunity to force us into some humiliating compromise. The Russians were on the verge of sending manned spacecraft into extended orbital flights and robot probes out to explore Venus. We were way behind in the space race and none of the services had the budget or the ability to get us back into the fight. NASA was telling the president they would have to dig in, develop the technology base, and, by the middle of the decade, put on a show for the whole world. But now, as the year turned, it was all silent running until we could put something up we could brag about. The Army was making ominous noises about events in Southeast Asia. The more the Army pushed to get troops on the ground, the more the Kennedy administration refused to get involved. The Army was telling the president we would eventually be sucked into a war we could not win and the events would control us instead of our controlling them. Later that same year, I would be offered the job of Director of Intelligence for the Army Special Forces units already operating in the Southeast Asian theater. At about the same time the Army said it was going to name General Arthur Trudeau as the commander of all U.S. forces in South Vietnam. As our names were being circulated, General Trudeau confided to me that he doubted we would get the jobs. And if we did, he said, it would be a toss-up as to who would be the most unhappy, the Viet Cong or the U.S. Army. If they send us over there, Phil, he said after one of our morning briefings, one of two things will happen. Either we'll both get court-martialed or we'll win the damn war. Either way there. Army's not going to like the way we do business. As usual, General Trudeau was right. Before the end of 1962 and right about the time the old man was making up his mind whether to retire or not, His name was vetoed as the commander of all U.S. forces in Vietnam, and I was told to stay at my desk. The handwriting was on the wall. Vietnam was going to be a 104 political war run by the disinformation specialists at the CIA and fought under a cloud of unknowing. Unfortunately, history proved us to be correct. By the time Richard Nixon surrendered to the Chinese and we crawled out of Southeast Asia a few years later, we would learn, I hope for the last time, what it was like to be humiliated on the battlefield and then eviscerated at the negotiating table. The new year brought J. Edgar Hoover over to the Pentagon. The FBI director was growing increasingly anxious at all the Roswell stories circulating like ice-cold currents deep under the ocean throughout NASA and the civilian intelligence agencies. Somebody was conspiring about something, and that meant the FBI should get involved, especially if the CIA was messing around in domestic issues. Hoover didn't like the CIA, and he especially didn't like the cozy relationship he thought President Kennedy had with the CIA, because he believed his boss, the president's brother, was keeping him on a short leash when it came to ticking on the agency about territorial issues. Hoover knew, but didn't believe, that after the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy had become very suspicious of the intelligence information he was getting from the CIA. By the end of 1962, the president would learn from his own brother, who would learn from me, just how deliberately flawed the information coming out of the CIA was. And I would also learn, when I worked for Senator Russell on the Warren Commission in 1964, how that had sealed his fate. But in 1962, still near the height of his power, J. Edgar Hoover was as territorial as any lifetime bureaucrat in Washington could be. And when somebody stepped on his toes, or when he thought someone had stepped on his toes, he kept kicking them until the guy was dead. Even his own agents knew what it was like to get on his bad side. I was as territorial in my own way as the FBI director was in his, and during my years at the White House under President Eisenhower, we had established a professional relationship. If he needed to know something that bore on some KGB agent nosing around the government, I helped him out. If I needed to find something out on the QT about somebody I needed to take out of the bureaucratic loop, he would tell me what he knew. We never established any formal relationships in the 1950s, but we let each know who we thought the bad guys were. In the 1950s, Hoover got interested in the rumors about Roswell because anything the CIA got their teeth into made him nervous. If it were only the military running a cover-up, he could live with that, although he thought the military never should have run the OSS during World War II. But once he suspected the CIA was part of the Roswell story, he wanted in. But in my years on the White House staff, there wasn't much I could tell him. It wouldn't be until 1961 that I got my hands on what really happened at Roswell, and then I didn't have to contact him. He called me. We found we could help each other. Besides being territorial, J. Edgar Hoover was an information fanatic. If there was a bit of information floating around, whether it was rumor or truth, Hoover was obsessive about putting it into his files. Information was such a valuable commodity to him, he was willing to trade for it with anybody in government he trusted. I wanted information, too. I was going out to meetings with scientists and university researchers whose loyalties I couldn't verify. I had to be very circumspect about the technological information I was delivering, and many times I needed to know whether a particular chemist or physicist had ever been suspected of dealing with the communists or, worse, was on the payroll of the CIA. In retrospect, I can see how all this smacks of the thinking of Senator Joe McCarthy, but I was at the White House during the Army McCarthy hearings, and I can tell you straight out that Joe McCarthy, unwittingly, was the best friend the communists ever had in government. Single-handedly, Senator McCarthy helped give respectability to a bunch of people who would never have had it otherwise. He turned behaving in contempt of Congress into a heroic act by his very tactics, and the communists in government were laughing at the free rein he gave them. All they had to do was provide him with a human sacrifice every now and then, someone completely unimportant or actually innocent of any wrongdoing, and McCarthy pilloried them on television. But when he turned against the U.S. Army, he crossed into my territory and we had to shut him down. The communists used McCarthy to give them good press and open up an area where they could work while the anti-communists were made to look like fools. I told this to Robert Kennedy, who as a young lawyer had been a member of Roy Cohn's investigative staff working for the McCarthy subcommittee and who had learned firsthand what it was like to be completely misled into self-destructive behavior. It was a mistake, he confided to me, that he would never make again. Unfortunately, his brother's enemies were his own, and he was misled into thinking that being president would allow him to settle the score. But in January of 1962, all that was on my mind was re-establishing a relationship with J. Edgar Hoover so that I could pursue my agenda while keeping a lookout for who might be dangerous out there in there. 105. Academic community. Now I had something to bargain with for the information I wanted. Not only did I have the bits and pieces of the Roswell story that I knew Hoover wanted, I also had information about the domestic activities of the CIA. Hoover was more than interested in sharing information, and we continued to talk right through 1962 until I left the army and went over to Senator Thurman's staff. Our relationship continued right through 1963. And in 1964, when I was an investigator for Senator Russell on the Warren Commission and Hoover was pursuing his own independent investigation into the president's assassination, he and I could only stare at one another again on either side of the abyss of that crime. Stacked up against the enormity of what had happened, Hoover and I both understood that there are some battles you cannot win. So you leave them alone so you can fight another day. I'm not sure whether J. Edgar Hoover ever really believed that the Roswell story was true, an absolute conspiracy to cover up something else, or just a delusion that became mass hysteria out there in the desert. There were so many details buried in army memos and maintained under layers of cover stories fabricated by military intelligence experts that he couldn't possibly know the truth. But like the good cop that he was, he took information wherever he could find it and kept on searching for something that made sense. If the army saw a threat to our society, then Hoover thought there was a threat. And whenever he could follow up a report of a sighting with a very discreet appearance by a pair of FBI agents to interview the witnesses and get away with it, he did. He was more than willing to share that information with me, and that was how I found out about some of the unpublicized cattle mutilation stories in the early 1960s. My J. Edgar Hoover connection was important to me as I began my work in the early weeks of 1962 because the level of research into the types of projects we were developing became very intense. The rumors of General Trudeau's appointment to the Southeast Asia Command and my selection as intelligence director for the Green Berets in Southeast Asia, as vague and unconfirmed as they were, set a deadline for the general and me to push our projects forward because we knew we had only a year or so left on our tenure at R&D. So when the FBI director and I would talk, I had questions ready to ask. No information we ever shared was in writing, and any notes that I took from the conversations we had I later destroyed after committing them to memory or taking action on the things he said. Even to this day, although FBI agents have contacted me about records supposedly still left in the old files, I don't know what notes the FBI director took about our conversations and what specific actions he ever took. Because we trusted each other and remained in contact once every 6 months or so even after I left government service, I never followed up on anything I said and never asked for any verification of information in the files. I think Hoover appreciated that. By February of 1962, I had lined my nut file projects up for an end run that would take me to the end of the year and either South Vietnam or retirement. The first folder on the desktop was the glass filaments. Fiber optics. Members of the retrieval team who foraged around inside the spacecraft on the morning of the discovery told Colonel Blanchard back at the 509th that they were amazed they couldn't find any conventional wiring. Where were the electrical connections? They asked, because obviously the vehicle had electronics. They didn't understand the function of the printed circuit wafers they found, but, even more important, they were completely mystified by the single glass filaments that ran through the panels of the ship. At first, some of the scientists thought that they comprised the missing wiring that also had the engineers so confused as they packed the craft for shipping. Maybe they were part of the wiring harness that was broken in the crash. But these filaments had a strange property to them. The wire harness seemed to have broken loose from a control panel and was separated into 12 frayed filaments that looked something like warts. When, back at the 509th's hangar, officers from the retrieval team applied light to one end of the filament, the other end emitted a specific color. Different filaments emitted different colors. The fibers, in reality glass crystal tubes, led to a type of junction box where the fibers separated and went to different parts of the control panel that seemed to acknowledge electrically the different color pulsing through the tube. 106. Since the engineers evaluating the material at Roswell knew that each color of light had its own specific wavelength, they guessed that the frequency of the light wave activated a specific component of the spacecraft's control panel. But beyond that, the engineers and scientists were baffled. They couldn't even determine the spacecraft's power source, let alone what generated the power for the light tubes. And, the most amazing thing of all was that the filaments not only were flexible but still emitted light even when they were bent back and forth like a paper clip. How could light be made to bend? The engineers wondered. This was one of the physical mysteries of the Roswell craft that stayed hidden through the 1950s until one of the Signal Corps liaisons, who routinely briefed General Trudeau on the kinds of developments the Signal Corps was looking for, told us about experiments in optical fibers going on at Bell Labs. The technology was still very new, Hans Kohler told me during a private briefing in early 1962. But the promise of using light as a carrier of all kinds of signals through single filament glass strands was holding great promise. He explained that the premise of optical fibers was to have a filament of glass so fine and free of any impurities that nothing would impede the light beam moving along the center of the shaft. You also had to have a powerful light source at one end, he explained, to generate the signal, and I thought of the successful Ruby laser that had been tested at Columbia University. I knew the Ebbies had integrated the two technologies for their glass cable transmission inside the spacecraft. But what makes the light bend? I asked Professor Kohler, still incredulous that the aliens seem to have been able to defy one of our own laws of physics. Is it some kind of an illusion? It's not a trick at all, the scientist explained. It only looks like an illusion. Because the fibers are so fine, you can't see the different layers without a microscope. He showed me, when I gave him the broken pieces of filament that I still had in my nut file, that each strand, which looked like one solid piece of material enclosing the circumference of a tiny tube, was actually double-layered. When you looked down the center of the shaft, you could see that around the outside of the filament was another layer of glass. Dr. Kohler explained that the individual light rays are reflected back toward the center by the layer of glass around the outside of the fiber so that the light can't escape. By running the glass fibers around corners and, in the case of the Roswell spacecraft, through the interior walls of the ship, the aliens were able to bend light and focus it just like you can direct the flow of water through a supplely pipe. I'd never seen anything like that before in my life. Kohler explained that, just like lasers, the light can be made to carry any sort of signal, light, sound, and even digital information. There's no resistance to the signal, he explained. And you can fit more information onto the light beam. I asked him how the Ebbies might have used this type of technology. He suggested that all ships' communication, visual images, telemetry, and any amplified signals that the vehicles sent or received from other craft or from bases on the moon or on Earth would use these glass fiber cables. They seem to have an enormous capacity for carrying any kind of load, he suggested. And if a laser can amplify the signal, in their most refined form, these cables can carry a multiplicity of signals at the same time. I was more than impressed. Even before asking him about the specific types of applications these might have for the army, I could see how they could make battlefield communications more secure because the signals would be stronger and less vulnerable to interference. Then, 107. Professor Kohler began suggesting the uses of these fibers to carry visual images photographed in tiny cameras from the weapons themselves to controlling devices of the launcher. Imagine, he said, being able to fire a missile and actually see through the missile's eye where it's going. Imagine being able to lock onto a target visually and even as it tries to evade the missile, you can see it and make final adjustments. And Kohler went on to describe the potential of how fiber optic spaced sensors could someday keep track of enemy movements on the ground, carry data-heavy visual signals from surveillance satellites, and pack very complicated multi-channel communications systems into small spaces. The whole space program is dependent upon carrying data, voice, and image, he said. But now, it takes too much space to store all the relays and switches and there's too much impedance to the signal. It limits what we can do on a mission. But imagine if we could adapt this technology to our own uses. Then he looked me very squarely in the eye and said the very thing that I was thinking. You know this is their technology. It's part of what enables them to have exploration missions. If it became our technology, too, we'd be able to, maybe we could keep up with them a little better. Then he asked me for the Army's commitment. He explained that some of our research laboratories were already looking into the properties of glass as a signal conductor and this would not have to be research that was started from complete scratch. Those kinds of start-ups gave us concern at R&D because unless we covered them up completely, it would look like there was a complete break in a technological path. How do you explain that? But if there's research already going on, no matter how basic, then just showing someone at the company one of these pieces of technology could give them all they need to reverse engineer it so that it became our technology. But we'd have to support it as part of an arms development research contract if the company didn't already have a budget. This is what I wanted to do with this glass filament technology. Where is the best research on optical fibers being done? I asked him. Bell Labs, he answered. It'll take another 30 years to develop it, but one day. Most of the telephone traffic will be carried on fiber optic cable. Army R&D had contacts at Bell just like other contractors we worked with, so I wrote a short memo and proposal to General Trudeau on the potential of optical fibers for a range of products that Professor Kohler and I discussed. I described the properties of what had been previously called a wiring harness, explained how it carried laser signals, and, most importantly, how these fibers actually bent a stream of light around a corner and conducted it the same way a wire conducts an electrical current. Imagine conducting a beam of high-intensity single-frequency light the same way you'd run a water line to a new bathroom, I wrote. Imagine the power and flexibility it provided the Ebbies, especially when they used the light signal as a carrier for other coded information. This would enable the military to recreate its entire communications infrastructure and allow our new surveillance satellites to feed find store potential targeting information right into frontline command and control installations. The Navy would be able to see the deployment of an entire enemy fleet, the Air Force could look down on approaching enemy squadrons and target them from above even if our planes were still on the ground. And for the Army it would give us an undreamed of strategic advantage. We could survey an entire battlefield, track the movements of troops from small patrols to entire divisions, and plot the deployments of tanks, artillery, and helicopters at the same time. 108. The value of fiber optic communication to the military would be immeasurable. And, I added, I was almost certain that a development push from the Army to facilitate research on the complete re-engineering of our country's already antiquated telephone system would not be seen by any company as an unwarranted intrusion, I didn't have to wait long for the general's response.
Do it, he ordered.
And get this underway fast.